The U.S. locks up more people than any other country in the world, with 2.3 million people behind bars. One-third of the U.S. population has a criminal record. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. The Wheelhouse will be back next week, in place of our usual political roundtable. Today, I'm guest hosting a different conversation about criminal justice reform. Each year, nearly 10 million people will cycle through America's jails and prisons. The challenges they face are monumental, from jobs to housing to reconnecting with families. Over the last 10 years, we've seen a growing bipartisan commitment to addressing the challenges faced by those leaving prison. As we prepare to inaugurate a new president, and Jeff Sessions is set to become Attorney General, the question emerges: what's at stake for communities across the nation? Later in the hour, I'll talk to Reginald Dwayne Betts about how spending 8 years in prison shaped his current path as a Yale-educated lawyer and published poet. But first, Glenn Martin. He's the founder and president of Just Leadership USA, the country's first organization empowering the formerly incarcerated to guide criminal justice reform. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Hey, glad to be on. Thank you.
So, Glenn, you and I met actually about 8 years ago when you were leading a training program for a fellowship that I was part of. And I remember being struck by your ability to really humble all of us. So we went in thinking we knew everything that we needed to know about incarceration and about reentry. And you made it clear during that session that we weren't the experts. Why is this issue so important to you?
Sure. As someone who served 6 years in prison, I learned during that time a few things. One, that we lock up some of America's best and brightest. Two, that people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And then after emerging from the criminal justice system and realizing that there were some very well-intentioned folks working on criminal justice reform, but not really creating a space for the experiential lens of people who've been in the system to be a part of those discussions in a meaningful way, I just thought that people were working at cross purposes and really wanted to open up a space for voices like my own to be a meaningful part of those discussions.
So you mentioned that those who are closest to the problem are also closest to the solution. What do you see as the problem, and what kinds of solutions are you working toward?
Well, you know, if you look forward in this country at undoing mass incarceration, it seems truly daunting. But if you look historically in this country and elsewhere, if you look at movement building, it takes for people who've been most oppressed by a system to emerge and to define that oppression and then to help the rest of us find a way out of the problem. And so when we say people closest to the problem are closest to the solution, we first believe that the people who've been hurt most, the people who've been harmed most by mass incarceration, need to help others to understand what that harm looks like and how it has affected them as individuals, their families, and their entire communities. And when you get to a point where you have a policy like mass incarceration that has now criminalized 70 million Americans, it's no longer the narrative that we've all been taught about some small group of people that have done something wrong that we need to figure out what to do with. You know, we have a narrative about sending people who've done bad things to jail. A jail is a place for people who've done bad things, bad people who've done bad things. And when I went to jail, I asked myself, well, wait a minute, where do we send good people who've done bad things? Because I met some really amazing folks there who taught me to be the leader that I am today. And who has the most stake in the outcome of criminal justice reform than people who've been on the inside? And I've been able to help carry those voices all the way to D.C., even having the opportunity to meet with our president to have these discussions. And so it's not to suggest that we shouldn't be building broad coalitions to undo mass incarceration, but it is to suggest that we will never hit a tipping point with the type of organizing that it takes to undo mass incarceration if the very people who are most impacted are not leading the way.
So that popular narrative that you mentioned about the people who go to prison or those who return tends to focus on two very different stories. So it's either the story of the person who got out of prison, committed another horrible crime, and becomes the poster child for why we shouldn't reform the system,
Or the opposite is the person who was released, had, you know, this excellent time afterward and becomes the exemplar that if this person could make it, everyone else could. And I imagine that the truth is somewhere in the middle. What does that path really look like for people coming out of prison?
Well, first of all, you know, the media is part of what got us here. And if it bleeds, it leads. And so the cases where people come out and they reoffend and go back are the ones that capture the imagination of the evening news and is fed to the American public and has been the situation for 4.5 decades. And then there are folks like me who go to prison and have the opportunity to go to college. I earned a 2-year quality liberal arts degree, something that's rarely available to people in prison since Bill Clinton signed the crime bill in 1994. And then come out and emerge as a leader, and people point to me and they say, well, look, he's the exception. And they do that in ways that is minimizing of, one, what it took to get to where I am, but also it fits with the narrative that they've been taught. When you have an entire generation that's heard the same tough-on-crime rhetoric for 4.5 decades, it's hard for them to hear a story that suggests that that narrative is not true. It's hard for them to shake loose what they already believe, except I am not the exception. I've just been exposed to exceptional opportunities all along the way. And my organization, we take those very same people who have shown evidence of leadership either while they were in prison or post-release, and we expose them to not just opportunities but to the types of networks that by definition the people who are most marginalized really have access to, and they emerge as stronger leaders. We've trained 222 people in 27 states and Washington, D.C., and they're all at the forefront of criminal justice reform around the country. And so you're right. The truth is somewhere in between, and yet the narrative that we've all been taught to believe is so much stronger than even the truth right now. And yet the more we create a space for formerly incarcerated people to emerge as leaders and tell stories that are so much more truthful than the narrative we've all been taught, is the closer we get to a tipping point.
So in terms of those stories, we often hear this dichotomy between violent offenders or people who've committed violent crimes and those who were committing nonviolent crimes. And the sort of narrative is that that should make a difference in what happens to people when they go into prison, but also what should happen once they are returned. In terms of your personal experience and the work that you're doing with Just Leadership USA, what leads us into that path?
So our criminal justice system is set up in a way that is extremely binary, good, bad, offender, victim, nonviolent, violent. And people, the system has grown so large and it's become so formidable and so difficult to control that you really have to label people and put them on a track and send them on their way. And so having labels like violent, nonviolent works for a system that is so large and chews through so many people and causes so much human carnage that you really need to quickly find a way to label people and send them on their way to keep the system moving along. And yet the reality of these labels is just not the reality that people face in the communities that end up in the criminal justice system. So if you think of myself, the truth of the matter is that it really depended on which day I got arrested, whether I had a violent crime or a nonviolent crime. I mean, I grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, when it was a much tougher neighborhood than it is today. We called it Bed-Stuy Do or Die. And, you know, one week I could be hustling and selling drugs, and the next week I could be doing what I ended up getting caught for, which was having a gun in my waist and committing a robbery. And yet once you get that label and you go into the system, you face extremely different experiences and outcomes as a result. And, you know, I would go even further. The nonviolent, violent label is something we need to take a close look at because it doesn't fit the reality of the lives of the people who've been through the system. And I would argue that people who get arrested for violent crime deserve access to opportunity and chances for transformation and redemption, just like people who've been convicted of nonviolent crimes. And I think, you know, progressives also fail the test when it comes to their messaging around criminal justice reform. I think of Rockefeller drug law here in New York State, Rockefeller drug law reform, which I was heavily involved in from 2005 to 2009, when we achieved the most significant victory. We helped eliminate 95% of New York State's mandatory minimum drug laws. But here's where we failed. We spend a lot of time convincing the legislature that nonviolent drug offenders didn't deserve to be in prison. And then when we scored a win in 2009, we've scored almost no wins since then. Why? Because the implicit message behind nonviolent drug offenders not deserving to be in prison is that everyone else deserves to be there. And so now the legislature often looks at the advocates and says, what do you mean? We did what you asked us to do. We took care of the folks who didn't belong there. And the problem is that we didn't talk about what there is, what the system is, and how it chews through people, whether they get convicted of a violent or a nonviolent crime. And it's not just nonviolent violent. It is also victim offender. You know, I remember sitting on a panel with the Manhattan District Attorney, Cy Vance, about 2 years ago. And after talking for about 30 minutes, he said, hey, wait a minute, Glenn, you know, we haven't said anything about victims. We've talked all about reentry and people exiting prison. And just viscerally, I turned to him and said, you know, DA Vance, with all due respect, I didn't learn how to pull out a gun on someone until someone pulled out a gun on me. But your office didn't think of me as a deserving victim at the time. And, you know, young black men are the most prevalent victim of violent crime by definition. Communities that are high crime and high incarceration are also high victimization. And yet that doesn't fit with the narrative that we've taught Americans either about what victims look like, usually white women sitting in the hospital post-attack, and what offenders look like, usually big, strapped, bald black men who are violent. And until we break down those stereotypes, whatever we build to undo mass incarceration will just turn out to be the newest system of oppression, in my opinion.
So some people will focus on a key point in what you just said, and that is those convicted of a crime. So if I'm someone who believes that people who do harm to their community and are convicted of a crime deserve to be punished, and I'm not really moved by the social justice argument or the idea that the system in place has racial undertones to it, why should those people care about this issue? What's at stake for people who don't break the law or don't feel like they live in a community where this is an issue?
Sure. That's a really good question. And so I spend a lot of time talking to victims of crime. For me, sometimes when I'm talking to people who've been convicted of a crime, they also fit that dual definition of survivors of crime. But I've also talked to survivors of crime who have never been convicted of a crime themselves. And I ask them, what do they want? What do they want out of a criminal justice system? And yes, some people want retribution. And that is one of the things that drives our criminal justice system. Unfortunately, the other values that should drive our criminal justice system are missing. Citizenship and social justice and parsimony and proportionality and the type of things that at least rhetorically we suggest exist in our criminal justice system. But the thing that most victims tell me they want is for the offender, quote unquote, to never do it again. And we have a criminal justice system where 2/3 of the people who emerge from prison reoffend. And so if you don't have a social justice bone in your body, but you care about victims and you care about public safety, then how can you continue to invest in a system that leads to reoffending across the board systematically for the past 4.5 decades? The fact of the matter is that what we're currently doing simply is not working. It is extremely expensive. By some accounts, we're spending $1 trillion per year on incarceration. Locally here in New York City, where we at Just Leadership USA are running a campaign to close down Rikers, we're spending $209,000 per bed per year in a facility where 89% of the people are people of color, where you have one correction officer for every detainee, and probably most importantly, where 81% of the people on Rikers Island are only charged with a crime and not convicted of anything.
Today we're talking about prison reform with Glenn Martin, founder and president of Just Leadership USA. They work with the formerly incarcerated to guide criminal justice reform efforts. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. We'll hear more after this break. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean, and today we're talking about criminal justice reform with guests who have direct experience transitioning from prison to citizen. Later we'll hear from a Yale law grad and poet who works as a public defender in New Haven. Joining me now is Glenn Martin, founder of Just Leadership USA. His organization has a goal to cut the prison population in half by 2030. I asked him what it would take to get there.
When you think of the scope of the problem, the work that even I have engaged in for much of my career, but definitely much of the work that's happening in criminal justice reform, feels pretty incremental to people who've been directly impacted by the system and people from communities that have been demanding for a long time for a better answer from government in response to crime. And if you think of the civil rights era and all of the gains that we made, if you think of what I call the four E's, employment, education, equality, and enfranchisement, think of how the criminal justice system has come along and emerged as a system that really robs people of all of those things. Anyone who's been involved in the criminal justice system has now become the new underclass of citizenship in the United States. And so before we ask the question of, you know, what next and what replaces what we currently have, I think we have to ask the question of what sort of value should drive our criminal justice system, and why is it that the system we currently have is one that is built on systemic racism and gives us these disparate racial outcomes and yet surprises most of us? And how can we build something that is built on a whole new set of values? And then on a very pragmatic level, in terms of policy reform and what those levers are, let's just figure out how we got here. It's only been 4.5 decades. And so it's actually pretty scary that we've built such an insidious and wicked system in such a short amount of time. But I'm pretty hopeful in that if it's 4.5 decades, you can actually look back and see clearly what are the policy decisions that we made as a democracy. Mandatory minimum, truth in sentencing, 3 strikes laws, the privatization of prisons. It's pretty clear to put your finger on the things that got us here, with I think mandatory minimum being probably one of the most important policy decisions that we made. Why? Because we decided that judges were not tough enough and that we would take power away from judges and move it elsewhere in the courtroom. And the place we moved it is to prosecutors. And, you know, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you're a prosecutor, your response to crime is to lock people up. That is the menu that you have to offer victims, is prison time, and more prison time. And so why should we be surprised that our prison system has grown by over 800% in such a short amount of time?
Well, let's talk about the here. We're in a very interesting political moment, a challenging social moment. And over the last 10 years, we've seen this movement toward bipartisan interest in criminal justice reform. But we're preparing to inaugurate a new president, a new attorney general, which has a very different approach to these issues than what you've laid out. What does this space look like as we're talking about uprisings in cities? We're talking about the verdict and the death of Walter Scott in South Carolina. What does the here look like for you on this front?
You know, for me, first of all, we got here through bipartisanship. So let's be clear about the history and how we developed mass incarceration, where both sides of the aisle are equally guilty, if you will, of passing many of those policies that I mentioned just a few moments ago. And while our president, President Obama, has been a true hero and extremely courageous in not just changing some of those policies and using his executive power to commute over 1,000 sentences of people in federal prison, more than the last 9 presidents combined. And so you look at the bipartisan kumbaya moment that we allegedly have been enjoying around criminal justice reform, and you have to start out by asking yourself, has that really led to concrete reform? I mean, everything the president has done, for the most part, he's done through executive power. And Congress continues to be tribal on a host of issues, and their rhetoric around this issue has been great, and they've been willing to get in rooms together. But if you look at the bills that are even sitting in Congress now, they really amount to just a meaningful distraction. I mean, anything that gives people back their liberty, I see value in, especially if it doesn't cause additional harm. But those bills that are meant to take away mandatory minimums went to committee and came back with new mandatory minimums in them. And it gives you a sense of where we really are in terms of this bipartisan comeback coalition. So the way forward with the president-elect and his appointee to the Attorney General's office, I sent an email to our 222 leaders around the country And I just really wanted to take their temperature. And what I got back almost across the board is that our folks were ready to double down. There's something to be said about clarity of opposition. There's something to be said about not having the soft pedal and wonder whether or not you should be pushing back hard on your allies or people who are seem to be moving in the right direction. This is clearly an administration that is going to be oppositional to much of the reforms that are proposed by folks in the criminal justice reform space. And so what that means is that, you know, we dig in deep on the tactics that we believe work. You know, Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. That has never changed. That hasn't changed today. I mean, a big part of the opportunities I've enjoyed over the last few years for me clearly come from young people around this country risking their lives through Black Lives Matter and other movements to push people in power for reform. And I think that with this incoming administration, that is going to become so much more important. And what we should be doing as allies to young people is protecting them, saving their lives, helping them do their work in ways that doesn't cause physical harm or further damage, but at the same time supporting them when they realize that they're going to inherit this country and that they don't want a country with the sort of policies and values that we're holding on to so tightly right now instead of the promise of opportunity and hope and justice. So for me, not much has changed except, you know, going out there and seeking the resources to further invest in the people who've been most impacted, and then pushing our allies, those who have more access to power and privilege and resources, to not just recognize their privilege and step away from it, but to recognize their privilege and wield it in support of people who are on the margins and who need their support.
So, Glenn, the issue seems so massive and so multi-layered in terms of empowering new voices, connecting them to resources and opportunities. If you could suggest two or three concrete things that people could actually do right now, so they've listened to you, they understand some part of the issue, what do we do now?
There's a couple of things people can do. Storytelling is extremely powerful. And, you know, proximity is important. Like, people who are hearing my voice today, the voice of someone who served 6 years in prison, the voice of someone who spent a year on Rikers, who was stabbed four times during his time on Rikers Island, if you can tell the story of what this talk felt like to you and how you experienced it to someone else who otherwise would have no proximity to this issue, I think that that is as valuable as standing on the steps of the White House, picketing or protesting, because everyone is not going to do that. And, you know, you could do one big thing or you could do little things consistently. And I think both of those things lend themselves to movement building. So everyone won't have the proximity, but everyone has a story to tell. And it doesn't have to be the story of someone who's been in the system. It can be the story of how what mass incarceration means for you and how it doesn't line up with your own values. But I'll tell you, when I went to prison 20 years ago, I was going through reception, and I took a test to determine what type of job you'd have in the prison setting, whether you were going to be a porter or small engines or you name it. And a correction counselor walked over to me and he leaned over and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "You should go to college." And that was the first time anyone had ever said that to me, much less someone who was probably going to see 400 other similarly situated people that very same day. And so I tell that story because that individual planted a seed that day that grew into a tree that he may never enjoy the shade of. And every single American, every person who's hearing my voice can plant seeds similarly in people who either have been through the system, are at risk of going through the system, or just don't have a clue about what it means to go through our criminal justice system. And you may not know what the impact of that is today, but that sort of investment in other human beings, I believe, is how we build a movement to get to the finish line. Because the only way we have ever been able to push back on fear-driven policymaking in this country or elsewhere is to mobilize hope.
Glenn Martin is the founder and president of Just Leadership USA. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Thanks, Glenn.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, Reginald Dwayne Betts continues the conversation about his personal experience in prison and his current job working in the court system. Stay with us. I'm Kalila Brown Dean, and today we're talking to leading thinkers on prison reform and reentry. Joining me now is Reginald Dwayne Betts. At 16, he was arrested for a carjacking, a crime that landed him in prison for 8 years. Today, he's a poet and a Yale Law School Lyman Fellow at the Division of Public Defender Services here in Connecticut. His latest collection of poetry is called Bastards of the Reagan Era. Dwayne, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You recently graduated from Yale Law School, but you had this very successful path as a poet and writing a memoir that won an NAACP Image Award. Why law school?
Yeah, I think success as a writer is fickle, and I don't know if it's actual success. One is really challenging to measure the impact your work has had on people, but two, it's dangerous to think that the writing is a job, especially if you have to pay rent and you're not like independently wealthy. That's even harder for poets. So you can have a very successful career as a poet and literally live check to check, month to month, for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And so ultimately, I realized that I was writing and I had another life doing advocacy work, mostly around criminal justice reform, whether or not young people should be tried as adults and sent to prison with adults. And it got to this point where I had a really prestigious fellowship at Harvard, and I had it to write poetry. And one day I realized that this wasn't necessarily real life. You know, this was an opportunity for me to get paid to do something that I enjoyed doing, for me to finish writing Bastards of the Reagan Era. But it wasn't something that would, one, sustain me in a way that I could really do the advocacy work and not be stressed out over bills and rent. And two, the role that I had in doing the advocacy work wasn't necessarily the role that I wanted, because I was frequently the person who was invited to speak because I had been to prison. I wasn't necessarily the person that was invited to speak because I had this expertise. And more importantly, I feel like whenever you're in a room, a distinguished room, and everybody else is getting paid to be there and you aren't, you've made bad decisions in life. And so I had to ask myself, you know, how could I make better decisions? Because I wasn't controlling the room. You know, I didn't have real power or influence in the room. I was just invited to be in the room as an onlooker, or even as a participant, but it was momentary. Everybody else around me, it was their profession, it was their career. And I thought, what would allow me to have more skin in the game, so to speak? And it was going to law school.
So that credential for you of going to law school and having skin in the game, do you feel like that's a more influential credential than the challenges you had in the past? Or do you feel like it helps you set the tone when you're in that room?
Well, I should admit too that, you know, the answer to every question probably has 50 answers. And so, you know, that was one part of it. And it was a credential that allowed me to be in a room in a different way. If you've been in prison and you're black and you're a man, you're already perceived to be more violent than everybody else in the room and less intelligent than everybody else in the room. And so one of the things deciding to go to law school did was ended up, you know, going to Yale. One of the things it does is it removes that question, for the most part, of intelligence off the table. And I might have to deal with the question of, like, more violent than everybody else in the room forever. But at least in engaging in these questions around criminal justice reform, I don't have to be confronted with this sort of spectre of my own ignorance all the time. I don't have to be confronted with this notion that I have a particular role to play that's not one of my choosing. And so I think, yes, that credential has helped with some things. And more importantly, I think it's work. You know, I think being a writer is work. Writing poetry is work. But I'm somebody whose writing comes out of the life that I have lived and that I continue to live. And really, I think being a lawyer adds to my perspective about the things that I find important to write about.
So let's talk a little bit about that life that you lived, or the part of that experience. How did that shape Bastards of the Reagan Era? And what's really the takeaway for that, the experience in your life, but also this book of poetry?
You know, ironically, I actually think this book came more out of my experience teaching poetry. I taught poetry for about 5 years with the DC Creative Writing Workshop. A lot of these poems came out of the experience of working with young people, teaching them to write, writing with them. And I realized that, you know, we talk about the war on drugs, but even my generation, you know, I was born in 80. So in some ways, my father, like, his generation is the young men who were coming of age during the war on drugs. So some way in which I got the brunt of that in terms of, you know, basically whole communities seemingly being disappeared. We think it's over, but one of the things I recognized when it was the worst possible scenario with some of my students is I would see that all of them were still dealing with the ramifications of this, though, because, like, my father's absence had some kind of role in my life. And then whatever that role was, however things shook out, that had an impact on the life of, like, my son. And so my mm-hmm. students were sort of like the sons of this. They were actually, I think, I felt like they were in a large sense, and we all were in a large sense, the sort of bastards of this era. And so a lot of those poems, like, aren't about people in my generation. A lot of the poems are about people in the generation that was behind mine. You know, like, even my children, slightly older than my children, but my students could have been my kids. And so I think that's what the book was about. And the takeaway is, if you can see that it was extreme trauma and you can see that it was a profound amount of violence in the communities and injustice in the communities, then maybe you have to also admit that it doesn't just go away because you gave it a name. It doesn't just go away because people theorize about it. It doesn't just go away because we have created a space in which the notion of the war on drugs is common, like, just common conversation for everybody. It hasn't gone away. And so I think maybe that's the takeaway of the book, is that we need to seriously think about how we wrestle with the lasting impact of decisions that we make.
So if we think of trauma as generational and as community-based, so it's not just the one person who got in trouble,
right.
It's really about generations of family and generations of neighborhood. You mentioned a lot about your work with young people. Given those two guiding thoughts, what does criminal justice reform, meaningful reform, look like to you, and not just the buzzwords?
Well, first, I would say restorative justice. I would say that we have a practice right now across the country where we, one, pay lip service to what it means to be attentive to the needs of victims and their families, and we really don't even pay lip service to the notion that frequently they say things like the process is the punishment. But that's not just the case for the person that's locked up who has to go to court. Sometimes I have clients who, you know, they get transferred to the jail at 9 o'clock in the morning, shackled and cuffed. They get fed once at around 11. They might be there until 2:30, waiting to be transported back to some facility. And all of those multiple court dates become a process that itself becomes part of the punishment. They get sent to places where they can't get visits. And they can't get visits for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes the charges are serious, but sometimes the charges aren't serious, right? So in that way, the process is the punishment for them, but it's also the punishment for their families, who family members have to take off from work. Family members have to, even if it's a, you know, I could get this day off, but it's not up to you. It's subject to the schedules of the judges and the attorneys. And so I think we would take that more seriously. We would take more seriously the trauma that's caused by the children and the family members having to watch their child or their loved one go through this process. But more importantly, what it means to lose, especially like a domestic violence case. What does it mean to lose a provider? And this is not to say that domestic violence is okay. This is just to say that we have a system set up that is trying to answer certain questions and ignoring other questions. And sometimes those other questions are more pressing. And so if we had a restorative system, I think maybe we will be asking different kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. So that would be one step. And I think another step is it's frequently we as a community have no clue about how the laws work in our society. And you don't have to know all of them, but maybe we should just have some baseline understanding about what it means to punish and what kind of punishments we want to happen in our name, because the punishments always happen in our names. And then another thing I guess I would say is it's just difficult, actually, and it's more difficult each day that I work in a public defender's office. It's more difficult because I realize that victims, complainants, criminal defendants alike are all striving for a better life. The mass majority of them are striving for a better life. and that better and different life is always just out of reach. And we pretend that the criminal justice system is just this one issue problem. When in fact, you find that anytime I have a client, somewhere along the line, you see some other system that has failed them or some other system that was unable to realize our sort of hopes and intentions for that system on the lives of the people that they deal with. And so I think, you know, criminal justice reform has to be thought of as just not one issue, but it has to be thought of as being working in conjunction with education reform, with housing reform. Because I'm tired of having people come to me and saying, such and such just needs to get out of this community. But this is actually his community. Like, if that's what needs to happen, then we actually just need a bus that could transport all of the black people who are living in impoverished communities with poor schools and lack of opportunity and lack of jobs. We just need to be able to transport them where, you know, like maybe right. to the suburbs or, I don't know, maybe to outer space. I don't know.
So where do we start then? If all of these issues are so nested with transportation, with housing and education, where do we start?
Well, I mean, I actually think I think education is one place because it's easy. You know, I go to schools all the time and I don't see the community in the schools. But I also, you know, I see New Haven particularly, right? You live in New Haven and you see how connected Yale is to New Haven. But you see how many like really brilliant people come into this community to just go to school and to work. Then you go into a public school that's literally walking distance from the institution and you meet some kid. Like some kid told me at a local high school, you're the first black lawyer that I've ever met. Like, what? This cannot be true. First of all, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a second year law student. Second, you live like you could throw a rock and hit Yale Law School from here. So how is it that you have never met a lawyer? And the only reason I'm here is because one of my friends knows your teacher. How is that the only way that we can make this kind of connection between my institution in your institution? And so I think that that's something that we haven't really thought of.
So some people might look at you, so those kids may look at you and say, he made it, right? You are a graduate of one of the best law schools in the world. Okay. The best law school in the world. You have a career. You have a beautiful family. You're traveling all over the world, really, to talk about your work and to connect with young people. So those kids may look at you and say, you made it. Other people may say, he made it. And if he could do it, then there's no excuse why no one else can. Do you feel like you've made it?
So on the one hand, every decision that I've made since December 8th, 1996, which is the day I got locked up, has been partly born of desperation. And it's been partly born out of a need to do more than just like survive. And so in some ways I would push back on the notion of having made it because I think I have just struggled to figure out what it is that making it means. But then I would also say that people didn't think that I made it when I just taught poetry in DC. And so I would resist the notion that all of a sudden I made it because I was admitted to Yale Law School and graduated from Yale Law School. You know, when I was just teaching poetry and I hadn't published any books, I thought I made it. And I love my job and I would still be doing that job probably if there was the kind of funding. I mean, I would still be doing it if there was the kind of funding that allowed me to do it and support a family. And so, you know, the notion of making it is one I think is a slippery one. But two, I think it's dangerous if we start to categorize making it as achieving these kind of gold stars that we universally applaud. I don't know if graduating from Yale Law School is always a good thing anyway, you know, which is not to diminish my accomplishments, mm-hmm. but it's to sort of concede and acknowledge that sometimes we have to reconceptualize what it means to make it because everybody doesn't even want to do this, you know. So if this is not, you might not want to write poetry. I've been places where people don't like poems. And that's not what they want to do. What they want to do is have a job where they could come home each night and read to their child. And, you know, they want a job where, especially people coming out of prison, they might want a job where they don't have to think about prison every single day. They don't have to be burdened by that every single day. So push back. And then the other thing is to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And I think that's dangerous too, because how can somebody pull themselves up by their bootstraps when, one, we keep moving what the target is? You know, I went to law school partly also, I didn't mention it earlier, but I couldn't get a job. And it wasn't conservative organizations that were refusing to hire me. It was always the progressive teaching outfits that wouldn't hire me. It was the liberal organizations that wouldn't hire me when they found out I had a felony. And so what do we really mean when we say we want somebody to pull themselves up by their bootstraps? When we make it, you know, it was Howard University that denied my full tuition scholarship. I think it's a difficult question. But when I talk to kids, I don't think they ever approach it that way. Usually because I'm always cursing. And I try my best to maybe to sound like my father. Nah, shouldn't have said that. I mean, maybe. But I try my best to sound like, you know, my uncles, to sound like the men that I grew up with. I try my best to sound like myself. And in doing that, I don't think that they get this idea that I'm somehow apart from them. And I hope that they get the notion that, like, I'm just doing what I want to do. You know, I'm writing poems because I like writing poems. I'm not writing poems because that became my definition of what it means to be a successful person.
So I want you to think about where we are in this political and social moment. So the things that you are doing in your life, you've chosen this career path of public interest law. To think about this current political moment, to think about what it may mean historically and what it may mean moving forward for the kinds of issues that you're concerned about. What is it that you're thinking?
Other than the parking ticket that I'm about to get, which is also political. I don't know. I think that for 8 years, at least for me, for 8 years, it seemed like the ship had been righted, and the urgency was a different kind of urgency. And I think now we realize that if there are conversations that need to be had in our communities, that we need to be the catalyst for those conversations. But more importantly, like, I go to Hartford, and I'm trying to think about legislative change. I'm trying to think about changing things like money bail. When I go there and I go to the Sentence Commission and hearing, I see that it's not enough voices that reflect my experience. There's not enough people in the room that understand where I'm coming from. And so I think this moment weirdly forces us to reconsider what it means to be an agent of both change, but even just an active citizen in the community. And it's not all of us, but there's a lot of people that I look at who I say, you know, you should have been running for office, or, you know, you definitely could do a better job at this than X person. And I think before, you know, because we were in a different space and a different moment, it was easy to say, that's not what I want to do. But now you actually have to say, this is the thing that I should be working on.
So thinking about the things that we should be working on, if for some reason President-elect Trump called you and said, you're making the face, this is a hypothetical, right? If he called you and said, I'm putting together this commission, what's the one thing that I should be thinking about, or what's the one thing that I should be working on, what would you suggest?
I thought you was going to say something like, if President Trump calls you and say, we need a poet.
I mean, you could perform at the inauguration.
I'd be like, nah, I can't.
You know, Maya Angelou, Elizabeth Alexander, and you could do it.
Not for President Trump. I would be like, no. Or I would do something that then would get me disappeared, you know? So I don't know. I think if I was asked that question, I mean, the things don't change. You know, I think we have a wide array of issues, and sometimes we overstate the importance of federal policy on things like criminal justice reform. But I do think it's important, and President Obama did it in some very, like, specific ways in terms of visiting a prison, like changing the optics of how we think about men and women who are incarcerated. I remember being at a conference in which one of the reports that they had written was about young girls who were sex workers, and they were charging 15-year-old girls with prostitution, when it's like, wait, you under the age of consent. But this was a practice all across the country, creating long criminal histories for these young girls who were basically being abused and who were basically being used by people who were older than them, by people who, like, they had pimps, and the system knew it, and the police officers knew it, and yet these girls were getting these long criminal histories. And the question was, how do we transform the lives of these young women? And so I think, you know, if somebody asked me what should we be considering, I would say we need to be considering how we could double down on criminal justice reform and how we could do it in ways that don't obviously translate into media talking points. You know, sometimes they just translate into reimagining the landscape of ideas in this space. Because trauma-informed care is a crucial idea because, and this is specifically talking about juveniles, mm-hmm. but it's a huge shift from juvenile delinquent to somebody who needs trauma-informed care. And so I would say that we need to double down on those things. And I also would say that those things are what's most likely to disappear. You know, and that's quite unfortunate because I think those things help lay the foundation for the bigger things to happen.
So in an earlier segment, we talked with Glenn Martin, and Glenn mentioned that there's power in storytelling and that those stories personalize issues but also resonate and connect with us. So we would love if you would share.
I will. For the city that nearly broke me. A woman tattoos Malik's name above her breast and talks about the conspiracy to destroy blacks. It is just a fancy way to say that someone kirked out, emptied 5 or 6 or 7 shots into a still warm body. No indictment follows Malik's death, follows smoke running from a fired pistol. The officer's hand still smoking, crimson against concrete, an old story we're all too familiar with. And I hear the people say that the system is a glass house falling on only a few heads. That, and the stop snitching ads are the conundrum, and damn all that blood. All those closed eyes imagining Malik's killer forever called food to a series of cells, as if that brings justice. And I know it won't happen. I know the truth of the talking is just talking. I almost believe him. I do. But the cognac in my hand is an old habit, and I look outside and imagine there is a riot going on. And someone is tossing a trash can through Sal's window, as if that will change the story, as if that will stop the blame from going blameless for all the blood that flows black in the street. And we ignore what happens as the bodies that roll off the block and into the prisons keep rolling. As Malik's casket keeps closing, and as we all ignore the fact that what is happening is America strangling itself.
Reginald Dwayne Bett's latest collection of poetry is Bastards of the Reagan Era. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Bett's is a Yale Law School Lyman Fellow at the Division of Public Defender Services in Connecticut. Today's show is produced by Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Robin Doyon Aiken, Heather Brandon, and John Dankowski. I'm Kalila Brown Dean. The Wheelhouse will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Southern leaves, southern trees we hung from. Barren souls, heroic songs unsung. Forgive them, Father, they know this knot is undone. Tied with the rope that my grandmother died. Pride of the pilgrims, affect lives of millions. In slave days, separating fathers from children. Institution ain't just a building, but a method of having black and brown bodies fill them. We ain't seen as human beings with feelings. Will the U.S. ever be us, Lord willing? For now we know the new Jim Crow. To stop, search, and arrest our souls. Police and policies patrol. Philosophies of control. A cruel hand taking hold. We let go to free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus.